Meeting of the Climate and Energy Committee to order, and we do have a quorum. So with that, Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have, and I would move their approval.
Great. Any discussion or, excuse me, all those, wait, discussion first. We'll discuss it. Anybody have any discussion on the minutes?
Chair.
Representative Carroll.
I think you're outstanding.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
I will vote to approve.
Okay, good.
And if we were going to second, I'd second that.
So. Wonderful. Good. I think we see consensus coming. All those in favor, say aye.
Just
aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We've got several bills today, so we're going to try to be efficient with our time. First up, one of our committee members. Representative Bierman is going to present House File 2014. Welcome to committee, Representative Bierman. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the bill. And there was an amendment.
Great, and the bill is going to be laid over for possible, inclusion. And yes, there is an amendment, an A1.
Yes, Madam Chair, the A1. I'd like to move the A1. It's just a technical change suggested by Commerce.
Great. Any discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about your bill, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. For those of you who have been on this committee previously, you've heard this bill before, so for you, this will be a refresher. For those of you who are new to the legislature, we have the Commerce Department here to present some background, and we'll hear from a couple of testifiers. But just to kick off, to state the situation and the problem, I will just note a few conditions. In all of your counties and mine, only about 12 to 18% of energy-burdened constituents who qualify for weatherization services are able to access funding. Due to lack of state investment, Minnesota ranks 16th of the 20 northern tier states receiving utilizing weatherization funding from the Department of Energy. Up to 40% in some places of applicants are denied services due to pre-weatherization requirements. And this bill came out of a bipartisan task force in 2020 on which I served that addressed these needs. Now, with the passage of the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law and a contribution of more state funding in this plan, in this bill, we are poised to make progress on the nearly 300-year backlog we face if we continued at the current rate of delivered assistance being provided. So this bill is about creating energy efficiency and conservation, which saves money. This bill is about assisting the elderly and disabled in all of our communities. It's about safety and healthier homes for kids and families, and it's about creating sustainable jobs for years to come. So next, I would like to hear from the Commerce Department and then the testifiers if they are ready.
Great.
Madam Chair.
Yes, I think we have Michelle Grancy, Commissioner with the Department of Commerce. Welcome back to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Acom. For the record, my name is Michelle Grancy. I serve as the Deputy Commissioner of Energy at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm pleased to share testimony with you today regarding Representative Bierman's State Supplementary Weatherization Grants Bill. House File 2014 is similar to but not identical with the Governor's 2023 budget bill in aiming to increase the number of income-eligible households served in Minnesota by addressing significant deferrals, investing in homes to be safe and warm, and growing the clean energy workforce trained to make these important home improvements for Minnesotans who need it most. Homes with children, elderly or disabled occupants, or those having a high energy burden or high energy use receive priority of service. The Wilts Flanagan Administration's Climate Action Framework has set a goal to weatherize a quarter of the homes in the state that have a household income of 50% of the state's median income or less by 2030. Simply put, without getting more homes into the weatherization queue, we won't meet that goal or even get close. Pre-weatherization funding prepares more homes and more workers to qualify for the federally funded weatherization assistance program. It addresses major limitations in the federal requirements for the weatherization assistance program by assisting local service providers to serve those that are hard to reach, households that have structural building issues such as mold and moisture, and by expanding services in areas that have traditionally been limited by federal requirements such as multifamily complexes. A 2022 case analysis by the University of Minnesota of six states with similar weatherization conditions, Washington, Vermont, Colorado, New York, Wisconsin, and Ohio, identified six key elements needed for expanding services. One, sustainably increase weatherization funding. Two, successfully navigate deferrals. Three, set long-term goals with long-term gains. Four, address barriers to multifamily weatherization. Five, address workforce challenges. And six, provide administrative relief in order to rapidly expand the program. As the work ramps up, so do the needs of having a specialized workforce statewide able to implement the US DOE or Department of Energy's standard work specifications as Building Performance Institute certified weatherization workers. Providing pre-weatherization training dollars to develop a pipeline of workers via nonprofits, labor organizations, job training centers, and educational institutions will further educate the current and future workforce on the specific requirements needed to complete these services. So Commerce contracts with 23 local service providers across Minnesota to deliver services statewide. These service providers are primarily community action partnership agencies with three tribal nations, one other nonprofit agency, and one county development agency also delivering services. In total, the network employs over 220 people and over 280 independent contractors to weatherize households of weatherization assistance program clients. The services are comprehensive, utilizing a whole house approach in order to achieve on average 20 to 30% in permanent energy reduction through implementation of efficiency measures. Two-thirds of the funding is spent in Greater Minnesota. According to a national evaluation of the program, households save on average $283 or more every year based on a one-time infusion of funds. The program has served over 60,000 households with weatherization services since 2005. We anticipate serving an additional 22,000 over the next 5 years. That ramp up in service is significant, but it is still less than 17% of the total eligible households. That's why pre-weatherization is so important. Pre-weatherizing a home has health and safety benefits to the residents in and of itself, but that work also makes the home eligible for weatherization, so there's an amplification effect that improves on the return of investment. A recent three-year assessment found that 25 to 40% of the households that receive a home assessment were denied services due to a multitude of reasons outside of the scope of the federally funded program, including health and safety issues caused by major roofing leaks, extreme moisture, water and mold issues, major plumbing or sewer issues, asbestos-laden vermiculite, and dangerous electrical wiring, all in homes in which people still live in when they're denied services. So while the ECO Act, the Healthy Air Program, and changes to the LIHEAP transfer are now addressing some of these areas, there are limits to each of the programs in its singular ability to address the issues to receiving services. Finally, due to federal program restrictions, the current program inequitably serves homeowners over renters. In fact, a five-year assessment found that only 13% of all households that were served were renters. In response to this, these realities. As Representative Bierman noted, an informal weatherization working group, including legislators, low-income advocates, utilities, service providers, and other partners, were formed to assess barriers to service and establish recommendations for you all, Minnesota Legislature and state WAP leaders. From that working group, multiple specific recommendations were provided, including four that I'll share. One, supplement the federally funded weatherization assistance program with state resources annually for the next 10 years in order to ensure stable funding for a robust workforce to implement the measures equitably across the state. Two, allow for state funds to be utilized to address barriers to service, including but not limited to structural issues, workforce limitations, and outreach limitations. Three, provide legislative allowances for multifamily buildings to serve more renters. And four, engage stakeholders in the workforce development space to develop a coordinated statewide strategy that provides training across the state in areas of demonstrated need, factors equity into the effort, reduces competitiveness and increases synergy, and builds the needed workforce for the weatherization industry. With that, I thank you, Chair Acomb, for the opportunity to testify. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Bierman and you all as this bill and the governor's budget moves forward.
And Representative Susan P., did you have a question for the commissioner?
Yeah, it can wait till towards the, if you want to have the other plan people, whatever, yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I mean, I probably will have one for her.
But, okay. Yeah. Next on the testifying list, we have Bill Grant from the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Acomb and members. My name is Bill Grant. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. The partnership represents the 24 community action agencies that serve all 87 counties in Minnesota, 19 of whom deliver weatherization assistance to eligible households throughout much of the state. Through the federal weatherization program, we have been weatherizing single-family homes and multifamily rental buildings since the late 1970s. Weatherized homes see a nearly $300 average annual savings on their home heating bills. However, as Commissioner Grancy mentioned, at the current rate of homes completed, it'll take many decades to weatherize all of the income-eligible homes in the state. The bill in front of you today would allow us to accelerate that pace significantly by addressing a major barrier to program achievement, namely restrictive federal program rules. House File 2014 authorizes supplementary state grants for the purposes outlined in Minnesota's state weatherization plan. A top priority for such funds, as identified by the Commerce Department's weatherization work group from last year that Representative Bierman mentioned, is the installation of pre-weatherization measures to address building deficiencies that otherwise prevent energy savings measures from being installed in eligible homes. Federal program rules prevent expenditures on home repairs that must be completed before many homes can be weatherized. Currently, up to half the homes otherwise eligible for services must be deferred due to problems ranging from asbestos-laden insulation, outdated wiring, failing roofs, and inaccessible crawl spaces, problems common in many older homes. Supplemental and more flexible state funding would be a bridge to the federal program by allowing necessary repairs to take place prior to implementing traditional weatherization services. House File 2014 also begins to address the serious workforce shortages affecting the program, particularly in Greater Minnesota, by appropriating funds to recruit and train weatherization workers and provide financial incentives to independent contractors to perform weatherization services. Weatherization saves consumers money on energy costs, reduces climate warming emissions otherwise released to heat homes, restores and increases the value of aging housing stock, and preserves affordable housing that is now in critically short supply. The weatherization investments outlined in Representative Bierman's bill will deliver great value to Minnesota taxpayers, communities, and those who struggle every day to make ends meet. Thanks, and I'd be happy to take any questions members might have.
Maybe we'll hold off and finish the testimony before we go to questions. Next, we have Jason Foy with Tri-County Community Action. Welcome to committee, Mr. Foy. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Jason Foy. I'm the Weatherization Housing Director at Tri-County Community Action Partnership, which services Todd, Crow Wing, and Morrison counties in Minnesota. Pre-weatherization is important for all residents we service with federal weatherization grants. Managing a weatherization program, we run into deferrals weekly. Deferrals and weatherizations happen because homes do not qualify under current program guidelines. When we run into homes which cannot be addressed under current federal grants, we end up deferring the home until the problem can be resolved. On average, one out of every five homes we visit will end up being a deferral. One issue that's always broke my heart was clutter. Clutter may be easy to overcome, but not for everyone. Imagine you're walking into a client's home and that client is elderly and disabled, 70 years old and sitting in a wheelchair. During the audit, you walk around the home and you can sense the life that's been lived and you can see a struggle. No one has been around for years, and upstairs there are boxes of personal belongings covered in dust. Unfortunately, boxes are stored around areas contractors need to work, and funding limitations could prevent this home from being serviced by weatherization. With the appropriation of these funds, we would be able to address this and more common issues like mold or minor structural damage. With weatherization, everything can be calculated and verified. Energy modeling can verify the house is expected to save 10 to 30% energy or more on homes. Simple reasons for deferral, which on average may cost $500 to $1,000 to remediate, are preventing Minnesota residents from receiving federal weatherization grants. Homes which sometimes are spending $2,000 to $3,000 a year paying for energy bills, that burden is then put on energy assistance, our power companies, the entire gas and electrical grids. The burden is not just on one home. The burden affects all of us and the reliability of providing safe, attainable energy. The other important part of this funding bill is the recruitment and training of staff and contractors. Acquiring, training, and maintaining contractors and staff is a huge challenge for our network. We have other agencies who depend on local contractors to do the work and in-house staff. These contractors are small local businesses in all corners of the state. The contractors and staff are Minnesota residents who live and work directly in their communities. Having a diverse, robust contractor base and field staff working at agencies is important to ensure the housing stock of Minnesota is being improved not only today for the people who live in them and can take an immediate benefit, but for the people who will own those homes 20 to 40 years from today. We owe it to Minnesota residents to ensure they can access federal grants.
Thank you, Mr. Foy. And I think we have also one public, so one person signed up for public testimony, Aurora Watron with 100% campaign. Welcome to the committee. Please be trained for that.
My name is Aurora Vautrin, and I'm the Legislative and Political Director for the Minnesota 100% campaign. Thank you, Chair Acomb and members of the committee, for your time today. And I am here to testify in support of House File 2014, Representative Bierman's bill to support pre-weatherization home repairs and our home repair workforce. This bill closes important gaps in our existing state weatherization program, ensuring more Minnesotans and their homes have access to its benefits. Due to eligibility requirements and federal law, some Minnesotans are denied weatherization services until their homes receive underlying repairs, a barrier that excludes those who don't have the funds to cover these upfront costs. We are glad to see Representative Bierman's proposal to expand access to weatherization by improving outreach to homeowners, investing in pre-weatherization improvements, and supporting the recruitment and training of auditors, installers, and contractors who make these improvements. Thank you.
Turn to member questions. Representative Swizinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so you know, part of the some of these programs with the weatherization, you know, is there a clawbacks as far as when you sell a property? As far, you know, I know in some of these federal programs, and as far as they're concerned, that you know you have to hold on to the home for at least 10 years, otherwise you have to pay the part of the process, the project cost back. Is that at all included into this portion of money?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Swizinski, there are no clawbacks in the bill. If you want a further explanation, I can bring somebody back about that. But
sure.
They're not. Maybe Mr. Grant perhaps could comment on that. But I know that the work being done, it would be a problematic type of operation to figure out clawbacks or put that into the legislation, I believe. But
Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. No, I mean, this is a program that's been in operation for 50 years, and we've been weatherizing homes over that period of time. The program at the federal level has never required clawbacks of funding if an applicant should move or become deceased.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, my feeling on this, you know, foundationally is that if you're pouring money now, not in just to weatherization, but actually improvement, so you're replacing roofs, you're replacing whatever siding on the outside of someone's home, you know, you're actually foundationally changing the value of the home as well. And so you're adding assets. So you're taking your asset that could be worth X amount of dollars, using state grant money, putting it into this project for a home that doesn't currently qualify, into a program that already has shortages of funds because there's over applicants. So you're adding more people to the pool, but you're not asking anything back from that property or estate at a time of sale, which they would wholly benefit, whether it's a renter, you know. So if you're a rich investment owner that maybe owns an apartment complex because of the additions of this bill, if they were to sell this with new shingles on the roof or whatever that might be, you're adding real value. And I don't understand, you know, when the tax dollars are so precious, why you wouldn't do that.
Representative Bierman or Mr. Grant? Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Well, again, we're following the federal program rules here. These aren't the state's rules. Secondly, I would say that for many of the communities that we're weatherizing homes in, the value to the community of improving the housing stock certainly outweighs any individual benefit that might be accruing to a homeowner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, what would you say? So let's say we don't put money into pre-weatherization, which would be shingles or whatever that might be. How much of a shortage is there for houses that currently qualify the program, which are insufficient funds to do the current projects?
Mr. Grant.
I just wanted to clarify the question on, you're saying if we didn't do any pre-weatherization, how much shortfall would there be in the vast number of homes that are out there in your district and mine? I think I have seen up to 40% of homes. So we're talking about hundreds and thousands of homes in a county like mine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, you know, the reason I'm asking that is we're already seeing a shortage in the homes that we're able to service under the current program, under the current guidelines, without putting money into, you know, the exterior or the pre-qualification rules. And now you're going to add not only high cost changes, so the exterior portions that really, quite frankly, didn't qualify that home for a potential to be qualified for these grants. We're already not fulfilling that need. Now you're going to add piles and piles more homes on top of that pile of things that we can't keep up with. Does that jive with what I'm seeing as far as this bill and what it will do?
And maybe I just want to ask for a little clarification about what qualifies as pre-weatherization projects. Is that roofing? Is that siding? Maybe a little clarification about what is included in those categories might be helpful. Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair, it's really unique to the individual situation. We find homes, for example, that were weatherized or originally constructed in the 1940s and 50s that at the time the state of the art was vermiculite for insulation. And we've since found, of course, that vermiculite contains asbestos and would need to be removed, but also represents a health hazard in its current condition. So in that case, removing that not only improves the health of the occupants, but allows the weatherization work to proceed. So it really is unique to the home, and there are going to be cases where the repairs that would be needed would exceed the program's ability, even with the pre-weatherization funds, to conduct the work.
And then just to clarify, is repair or replacing a roof part of a qualified project for pre-weatherization or repairing or replacing siding?
Madam Chair, potentially, okay. In cases where attic insulation is the needed efficiency measure, You wouldn't put new attic insulation into a home that had a leaking roof. So that would be addressed first.
Thank you. That's helpful. And back to Representative Swazinski's question, I think Representative Bierman, you were going to respond.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, Mr. Grant did, that it does depend on the structure, and there are certain limits to whether they're going to provide that work on any given home. But I think, you know, to put it in perspective, most of these members in a community, I mean, I don't think we really have to think that people are in this predicament who are low income are thinking about house flipping or getting these benefits and selling the house quick and moving out. I mean, I think that if that was something that was happening, that was something to be aware of or is a focus of, you know, the it's just not happening is what I understand.
One final question, Representative Swazinski.
Can it be a really long one then? And just to kind of wrap it up, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman, you know, looking at kind of the way this is structured, you've got, you know, 2.6 million, 21 million in 2025, and then 690,000 going off into the sunset. You know, what is the estimate on like what could the agency potentially get by? And then from an educational standpoint, you know, one of the issues that we have across the state is competition within higher education and educational units. So one of the fears I have when you have, you know, a training program that might came up to this, and, you know, let's say you're a small town college or something like that that may or may not have a carpentry program, you know, are you going to compete with that program and steal potential candidates away from that? Or are you going to, or high schools, will you work with high schools as far as the education? Will they be allowed to apply for these grants to develop their carpentry programs within the schools? How will that work?
Madam Chair, I think I will let Mr. Grant handle that as well, since this is what he does.
Madam Chair and Representative, the training grant program is really designed to provide training support for this very specific certification that's required to be a weatherization worker, either an auditor at the front end when the homes are evaluated or a quality control inspector at the back end to make sure that the work was performed properly. So the training grant money is really tied very specifically to the needs of this program.
Well, who would qualify for that? Like, would a college, Madam Chair, would a current colleges be able to get that money, or will they just have to come to you and ask for it?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think that's probably a question for the department, but my understanding is that we would be working with a wide range of potential training avenues, be they vocational technical schools, high schools, and what have you. Yes.
And Mr. Eloff, I think, has something to add to that as well, please.
Madam Chair, in response to Representative Swazinski's question, I would just note that the bill on lines 323 and 324, in terms of who can get awarded training grants, a job training center or educational institution that the Commissioner of Commerce determines has the ability to train workers for weatherization careers.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Eloff. Next on the list, we have Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we have a blank appropriation in the bill. I see that we've got governor's recommendations, but we still get to decide what that is. So I was trying to go between the two to figure some things out. And in the bill, you have up to 10% training for training, up to 10% for pre-weatherization. I didn't see anything in the bill, and maybe I missed it, for administrative costs. I see the governor has FTEs of, starting in 2025, of six FTEs if you go to that level. But do you have a thought as to how much it would take administratively? We don't have a fiscal note. We just have the governor's recs. So, and you don't have, it's a blank appropriation. So I'm just trying to wrap my mind around the money part of it.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as far as any FTEs that Commerce would have need, I would have to defer to them. But I don't have a number, because as you said, we don't have an appropriation there. We're waiting on targets, so that might be a bridge we cross closer to the end.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That makes sense. I just thought maybe you'd have a set. Sometimes people put things in bills and say, you know, 2 to 5% for administration, and I just didn't see that language. If you had it in there, I may have missed it, but mm-hmm. That was really the question. I understand there's a lot of unknowns, and I'm just trying to put a little substance to what we don't know. But one thing did kind of, as you had a testifier, Mr. Foy, talk, and it didn't occur to me that someone's clutter in the house might be considered pre-weatherization. And I realize that you've got several sections of existing statute on lines 4.14 that are listed out. And I didn't take the time to right here to look up all of those three statutory references. But I'm wondering if you happen to know what does qualify for pre-weatherization, and would decluttering someone's home qualify, because he was saying 1 out of 5 homes that he encounters have some sort of issue, but decluttering a home is a very expensive, extensive process. I'm just curious, what say about that?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I would logically think decluttering is not part of the service that they would provide necessarily, but I'll defer to Mr. Grant on that one.
Mr. Grant.
And Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, the pre-weatherization, as you point out, is defined already in statute. I don't have the statute in front of me, but it is rather specific with respect to which kinds of activities. I honestly don't remember whether or not decluttering is an allowable activity or not. I'd have to consult the statute.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I see our wonderful nonpartisan researcher is looking that up. It just caught my ear, Madam Chair, because it's like, wow, that's a direction I didn't expect this bill to go. So it just caught my ear. While our wonderful staff is looking that up, I do have something that maybe you could put a little meat on for me, because it's just hard when we have we don't have a fiscal note, and I understand why, and we don't have numbers, and I get it because we don't have targets. But you had mentioned in the testimony that we have 280 existing contractors, and this bill is up to 10% of the appropriation to do more training. And I believe Mr. Grant had mentioned the fact that, you know, we're woefully behind, and Representative Bierman, you had even said it would take 300 years to really accomplish all of the need. So I'm just wondering, kind of, where is the tipping point where we begin to see some progress and some change? If we already have 280 contractors, and as you said, 22,000 more homes in the next 5 years can be weatherized at the current pace. But how much is it going to take to actually make an impact?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think the first point of tipping is getting some funding into this bill and beginning this process and building the workforce. So until we do that, you know, we're down. I think I mentioned in my comments we're 16th of the 20 northern tier states as far as number of homes that we are doing. Wisconsin next door puts $60 million of state money into this program every year. And it takes some time to do the training for people through the institute or wherever they may come from. And then I also think that we need to engage the labor resources that are out there. And in our previous committee hearing, Representative Swedzinski talked about, you know, the labor shortage. We also have a labor shortage. So it's not really possible to say that if we, you know, are going to be at a certain point in any given year, really, but we won't be anywhere close if we don't get the funding in line first and then begin to train workers through the Building Performance Institute and recruiting people through the CAP agencies who know that if they do the training, they will have a job going on into the future where they can do this as a living and make a career of it. So I'm not sure what that looks like, but I think we're in the dark about a lot of things with the economy right now, and this is another one. But the important thing is we start, we get the funding in place, and then we work on building out the workforce, and as we pick up speed, we'll do more and more.
And I think Mr. Eloff has a question, some clarification about your earlier comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, the statutory definition of pre-weatherization measure is quite general. It says it means an improvement that is necessary to allow energy conservation improvements to be installed in a home. And I assume that word necessary is referring back to the federal regulations. But in the bill at line 220 and 221, it says that these the grants can be allocated to install pre-weatherization measures established by the commissioner under a certain section of law in the ECO Act, which says that the commissioner was to establish a list of pre-weatherization measures by March 15th of 2022. So it may be that maybe the Department of Commerce knows more about what's in that list.
I see Deputy Commissioner Grancy coming up, so maybe she can come and offer a little clarification.
Madam Chair, representatives, I do not have the list in front of me right now, but I can speak to the fact that that list was developed by March 15th, as was designated. It was done in conjunction with a number of stakeholders and includes things similar to what we were talking about by way of mold and moisture remediation. So, you know, we have seen, and Jason, Mr. Foy would be best to be able to speak to some of the conditions of the households that he has been in or other service providers, but walking into a house that has black mold all around the bedroom of a child, right? Getting in there and being able to clean that out in such a way that it's a healthy environment again. We don't want to tighten up a home that doesn't have strong ventilation, clarity. You know, you think about, was it 2019, the winter of 2019 in February, when we got 11 inches of rain and the ground was still frozen? And if you drove through any neighborhood in South Minneapolis, you would see carpet across, strewn across everybody's yard, right? We are working with the elderly. We're working with people that are disabled. We're working with folks that do not have the economic means to be able to go and pull out that carpet, go and regrade or ensure that there's that water infiltration doesn't continue. So pre-weatherization measures can look like things like installing a sump pump in a 1950s home that now has water infiltration, right? As we put money into homes, we want to ensure that money is well spent and that the weatherization measures continue in the long term. So it's any number of things, asbestos remediation, but it's those things that are necessary in order to preserve the health and safety of the home and in order for the weatherization to take place. We can certainly provide the list for the committee.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That list would be very helpful. Again, this sort of took a conversation path I didn't expect at all. I know Representative Bierman and I had had a conversation offline before the committee and had a pretty in-depth conversation about this, but I didn't expect it to go there. So I appreciate that. I think before, I'm sure this is going to be a conversation possibly for the omnibus bill, so we can look at it prior to that. But it's just, it's a little bit hard for me to wrap my head around, because as you say those things, I'm literally, the dollar signs are flying in my head. I have a 1904 two-story home that had vermiculite, and it had to be remediated before the previous owners could sell it. And so that was something that they found that was an impediment in the market. So they remediated it and put new insulation in my very, very, very old attic. I still have different issues in that 1904 home. I understand that. I also understand how incredibly expensive it is to remediate those sort of things. And, you know, if you talk about roofs and siding, I mean, that's my small little two-story in-town home would be $14,000 or $15,000 to do the siding. And I don't even know what a roof is today, but these are, so what I'm trying to say is I can see this money for pre-weatherization getting gobbled up really, really quickly, because those things are incredibly expensive. Weatherization is expensive, but the things that you're kind of alluding to are rather expensive. So these are all conversations I think we need to have, because it, you know, even if we put the governor's recommendation was $21 million in 2025, that could not go very far, you know, depending on what is the allowable. The last question I'm going to ask is just, is there any kind of cap in the bill, or would you consider some sort of a cap on expenditures? As I just said, I mean, if we're going to do a roof and siding and, you know, pull out every, if a room is full of mold, there's a reason. As you know, you've got some sort of water infiltration, so you've got to pull off all of that sheetrock, and you've got to find the leak, and then you've got to probably pull out all the flooring. And maybe it's just that room, or maybe it's the adjoining or adjacent room, or the three, you know, I mean, this just, it could be a $60,000 remediation. It's, you know, I used to work in construction, and I know we've got, oh, he's not here. So Representative Meckland, I would normally point to, but he's not here right now, but he could tell you how expensive these sort of things are. So one, is there a cap of expenditures for pre-weatherization? And two, if there's not, is that something that you would maybe consider?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm thinking back to previous years when we had this conversation, and I seem to remember that there was a dollar amount affiliated with that, but I may need to ask Mr. Grant if that's the case. Or Ms. Cramsey.
Representative, I don't recall a cap on that, and I completely understand the concern. The challenge being that because all of the other spaces that we've utilized have caps, we keep walking away from the toughest projects. And so I think it's a worthwhile discussion for sure, and a difficult one, because every time we walk away, there's still a family living there. And these are families that, you know, a family of four maybe is less than 60,000. The average family that we're serving is making 18, 19, 20,000 a year. So you're absolutely right. They cannot afford to do any of these upgrades themselves.
Representative Swazinski, final question.
Thank you. And just to clarify, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned like carpet removal. Would this bill allow you to replace carpeting as well? So like,
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I have not heard carpet installation mentioned at all, which, you know, being a carpet retailer, that's getting the wheels turning on that, but sorry, no, I have not heard carpeting or flooring. This is a structural issues relating to tightening homes and making sure that their energy burden is very focused on energy burden, and that's what the bill is about.
And I will just say that we saw Mr. Grant shaking his head no, that that is not.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
So, Madam Chair, so the bill would fund the removal of a carpet, but not the reinstallation of it?
Representative Bierman and...
I'm just going off what the commissioner said. I'm just literally asking, trying to discuss this bill.
Commissioner Grant. Did you have an answer for that? We're going to bring Mr. Grant down. I think he has an answer for that.
Very well.
Thanks, Madam Chair and Representative. Again, and I think Representative Bierman just said this, these are improvements needed to complete weatherization work. Taking out a carpet, putting in new carpeting, not connected with weatherizing homes.
One final question, Representative Swazinski.
But Madam Chair, you mentioned if there's black mold in the home, that would have to get removed as part of the remediation, pre-weatherization. So if there's black mold in the carpet, black mold in the flooring, black mold, you'd have to pull that out. Am I correct? I mean, so am I understanding this correctly? Because I think we're on...
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative, you know, I think the suggestion that we consult the list of allowable activities that has already been developed and guides this program would be the best use of the committee's time.
Seeing no further questions, closing comments, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good conversation. A number of points that were brought up, and that's why we do committee hearings on bills. This bill is in its fifth year up here, and it's getting better all the time, and you've drawn out some more questions, and we will get some answers. Thank you.
And with that, the bill is laid over. Next on the agenda, we have Representative Hollins and House File 849. And as she's making her way to the table, Representative Collins moves House File 849 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I see there is a DE1 to get the bill in the shape that you'd like. Can you tell us a little bit about the DE1?
Thank you, Chair Acom, and thank you, committee members. The DE1 is an update to last year's previous bill, so we've got some updated numbers and updated provisions, and so it would get the bill into the shape I would like it to be in.
Any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So with that, Representative Collins, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. So this is a bill that I brought last year to upgrade electrical panels in houses, or I should say homes, not just houses. As I tell my constituents, this is maybe not the sexiest of topics involving climate and energy, but it is one that is particularly important in my district, where we have a number of 100-year-old houses that are at their absolute maximum capacity for electrical use. And so, you know, sometimes folks talk about getting an electric car, and there's absolutely no way on the panels that most of our houses have they would be able to do that, let alone getting something like an electric stove to replace their gas stove. So what this would really do is make sure that we are it creates a grant program to make sure that folks who are low income or moderate income would be able to upgrade their electrical panels. I think that it's an investment in equity and access so that nobody's left out of this energy transition that we are doing currently. It provides grants to get residential electric panels up to date. And I will say the cap is at 150% of the area median income, which is not a lot. You think in St. Paul, I did the math, and it's about $89,000, a little over $89,000 a year for a family of four. So we're not talking about high-income individuals. I would consider myself moderate income, and I do not qualify. So it makes the upgrades make sure that we're preserving the existing housing stock. It creates safer homes by replacing out-of-date fuse boxes with modern circuit breakers. It'll support good jobs in the electrical field, and it also expands consumer choice by making homes more ready for the innovative electric technologies that are currently being marketed to individuals. So I have several testifiers here to speak on behalf of the bill, and I would like to invite them here.
Great. We'll turn to the testifiers. First, we have Eric Fowler from Front Energy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you to the chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Fowler. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm a senior policy associate on Fresh Energy's buildings team. Fresh Energy is a nonpartisan Minnesota-based clean energy policy nonprofit dedicated to advancing the clean energy economy. And I am grateful to testify in favor of HS 849, which will provide grants to upgrade residential electric panels in low and middle income homes, both single and multifamily. Adequate electrical capacity is a major barrier to residential electrification and electric vehicle expansion, and it's often hidden. Right? Residents may not realize they need a panel upgrade until they're also getting bids on a heat pump or an EV charger. Whether residents pursue electrification for home comfort reasons, indoor air quality, climate pollution reduction, or energy independence, we know that our homes are continuing to electrify. This program helps to level the playing field with panel upgrade grants for low and moderate income Minnesotans so that that next generation of electric appliances and vehicles are available for all, not just for the wealthy few. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I will also be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fowler. Next, we have Andy Snope with IBEW, Local 292. Welcome back to committee, Mr. Snow. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Andy Snope. I'm with IBEW Local 292. We represent about 5,000 electrical workers who work throughout the state of Minnesota. Our members and the contractors that our members work for perform this work. And despite what Representative Holland said, we do think it's kind of sexy. So that's what we do. Our members and contractors perform this work. Much of that work of electrical panel upgrades for residential dwellings are performed by small electrical contractors, one or two person shops. While we move towards more renewable energy production and towards electrification, this bill is a piece of that puzzle to provide homes with the needed added electrical capacity to become electrification ready. In conjunction with electrical infrastructure upgrades to the distribution system, electrical panel upgrades will help to provide the homeowner with increased capacity and circuit expansion space to add solar production and energy storage, electrical vehicle charging, air source HVAC and air source water heating systems, and added electrical appliances within the home. This bill addresses the greatest need first, typically in areas of underserved communities. In my years in the industry as an electrician, I saw the greatest need for this work in the areas of the metro and rural parts of the state where the largest economic disparities exist, most typically in single and multifamily rental units, where most likely landlords are not going to make this investment, or homeowners don't have the economic means to make these investments in home energy and efficiency needs. This bill helps to overcome those economic barriers. The IBEW has been working with stakeholders on this proposal for quite some time. Not only does this bill provide the incentive for homeowners to upgrade electrical panels, but it also helps to provide an economic stimulus to jobs and also a jobs component by providing these grants to electrical contractors and electricians who perform this work. Again, mostly small businesses. The language within this bill reiterates that the state requirement that this work is performed by a licensed electrical contractor and electricians. Language within this bill also requires that workers employed by these electrical contractors are paid area standard wages and benefits. These requirements help to assure the homeowner and property owners that they will be receiving the highest quality installation using the highest quality, best trained individuals to perform this work. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for all your work with stakeholders to author and bring forward this bill. Committee members, please vote yes on 849. And I'm available for any questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. Next, we have Mike Robertson with Habitat for Humanity. Welcome to committee, Mr. Robertson. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Aikum. My name is Mike Robertson. I am the Brush with Kindness Manager at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. The mission of Twin Cities, as many of you probably know, is to bring people together to create, preserve, and promote affordable homeownership and to advance racial equity in housing. Our home repair program, called A Brush with Kindness, helps low-income homeowners maintain safe and stable homes. The vast majority of our clients make 30% of the area median income or less in the metro. And in every case, the home that they are living in is not only their largest asset, but it's also their most affordable housing option. As our work at Twin Cities and other developers evolves to include electrification and decarbonization, the bill under consideration is the right kind of resource at the right time to help us and other housing organizations leverage the value of solid existing housing stock and to pave the way for an electrical improvement that not only benefits the environment, but also addresses a major health and safety issue for the homeowners. Just a quick story. Patricia, one of my clients, is an African-American homeowner who's lived in North Minneapolis for over 30 years. Her home is immaculate inside and out, but she contacted us because as an older adult, she had some accessibility modifications that she needed help with, and she was also having some electrical issues and kept, quote, blowing fuses. When I assessed her property, the electrical panel was, in fact, a fuse box with four fuses for the entire house. Considering that current electrical code requires at least that many circuits in just the kitchen, it was clear that the circuits were simply overloaded and unsafe. So a typical panel upgrade pre-pandemic to a 200-amp service would have cost us between $2,000 and $3,000. But in this case, because it was a fuse box we were upgrading, we had to do the electrical meter and the mast and the overhead wiring, which pushes the cost at that time over $5,000. And I would say post-pandemic, a project like that would be almost double that. We were able to do that using program resources and made Pat's home much safer, but by removing the, and also by removing that barrier of pre-electrification, as others have stated, she now can more easily take advantage of clean, highly efficient green technologies such as rooftop solar, air source heat pumps for heating, cooling, and water heating. These improvements will be good for Pat's monthly expenses, the indoor air quality of her home, and of course good for the environment. Grants like the one proposed in the bill supplement available Inflation Reduction Act funding that we know is coming. They support the move towards a decarbonized economy, which we know is coming. They support affordable neighborhood housing stock. They support local trade contractors and housing organizations. And most importantly, they support the health, safety, and stability of homeowners. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. And our final testifier, Mike Full with Minnesota Power. Welcome to committee, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Bull here on behalf of Elite Minnesota Power, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of Representative Hollins' House File 849, and thank Representative Hollins for reintroducing this bill this year. We like this one. For our customers that wish to increase their efficient use of electricity, the home's electric panel, as you've heard from other testifiers, can be a surprising roadblock to doing so. As a general rule, the focus of these customers is on the excitement related to the electric appliance they wish to purchase, an air source heat pump, an electric induction stove, heat pump water heater, or on the vehicle, an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid. But these customers can run into difficulty when they realize their home doesn't have enough electrical capacity to support these electric appliances and charging equipment. And as others have shared, upgrading the electric panel can cost thousands of dollars. This is the barrier that Representative Hollins is working to reduce through this panel upgrade program. We support a reliable, affordable, and equitable clean energy transition, and this bill targets support to removing barriers for whom this additional cost would be difficult to bear. We urge your support for the bill, and thank you for the opportunity to comment. Representative Garofalo, my colleague Zach Martin is here to answer any difficult questions that you
might to that point.
I just want to ask a question of my, not the testifier, but also a constituent.
A constituent.
Who now has the misfortune of having me represent him at the Capitol. A serious question. If someone doesn't have the money to upgrade the electric panel in their house, how in Lord's name do they approve, how can they afford an electric car, a heat source pump, or rooftop solar?
Sure.
Those are large capital expenditures, and I'm aware of our co-ops providing incentives right now to get people to off-peak metering, but it seems like we are hearing another bill here to literally subsidize the entire chain of electrification. Can you just tell me, and Mike, I don't mean to be that accusatory of my question, but I mean, how on God's green earth does this work that if someone can't afford that aspect of the purchase and the upgrade, how can they afford those items?
Yeah.
And what I'll just say before turning over to the testifier, there are a whole range of possible improvements a person can make to their home, whether it's just an electric cooktop to an induction cooktop to rooftop solar. So there's a whole range of possible things, but I can certainly turn it over to Representative Hollins or Mr.
The question was, the point of question was
that
my constituent.
Okay, Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. I think that's the answer, is that there is a suite of programs that will be helpful to folks to enable their clean energy transition if that's an area that they would like to go into. So your co-op Dakota Electric provides significant opportunities in this regard. I think there are other programs around the state that will help with EVs, air source heat pumps, and now this panel upgrade program.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Representative Hollins, would you like to respond?
I just wanted to give a real-world example response, if he's going to pay attention. Representative Garofalo.
No, blame
Representative Holland.
I wanted to give a real-world example because my, whatever, why can't I think of the word? You know, the thing that heats my house.
Furnace,
that's the word. My furnace just went out.
Actually, wood boiler.
My furnace just went out recently, and it is a gas furnace, and I was interested in upgrading to something that was electrical. And I have the money to replace the furnace, right? But when they were like, yep, it's going to be another $10,000 on top of that just to upgrade the electrical panel and dig the line out, it was like, okay, well, now we're talking about like a $25,000 investment as opposed to a $15,000 investment. And so, obviously, as I said, I don't qualify for this program, but somebody could have the money set aside to make a larger size investment, and adding another $10,000 on top of it is just not possible. So, I mean, I do think there is room there where this would be beneficial to individuals.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, you know, it's just, I'm just interested. This is just interesting. So the bills that we're hearing today, we can replace roofs. I think we can replace carpets. We can replace siding. We can insulate the house. Now we can redo the electrical work, all on ratepayers and taxpayers' dime. Affordable energy is not affordable when you have to do all this to make the dream work, folks. You know, and the idea that we wouldn't consider, and I have an amendment here. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment as part of this conversation.
Okay.
Is this an appropriate time, Madam Chair?
I think
that it works.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to go different.
Let's go ahead and do the A1 amendment.
Right? It sounds good, because I think, you know, the conversation we're about to have, I think, kind of just glides in real nice. You know, whether it's a multifamily housing unit, which, you know, reading this bill, so you could be a multifamily, you could take a grant for a historic building in downtown Minneapolis, with the idea that you're going to rent it to low-income renters and then qualify to upgrade the electrical using this particular grant. And then at some point in time in the future, either sell that multifamily housing unit, or if you're an individual, because you want to, you know, buy a Tesla and plug it in your house, have the state of Minnesota taxpayers pay to upgrade the electrical system so that you can do such things, or a heat pump or whatever electrical thing you may want to buy, on the backs of either ratepayers or taxpayers, or both. The A1 amendment simply says that within a certain period of time, if you sell the property, whether it's a multifamily, whether it's a single-family house, that just 10% of the investment that the taxpayers in Minnesota made into your home would come back to the state. You can't argue that we're not adding value to people's homes, regardless if you're poor or rich or whatever. If you're redoing the electrical system so that you can plug in a Tesla into the home, I think it's just a small, not the, whatever. Whether it's, you know, this investment that we're making that sounds like it could cost up to $10,000 per home. This would mean just return it so that not every single dime gets to get transferred with you when you sell that home. That just $1,000 of that electrical grant that you receive would come back to the taxpayers of Minnesota. And you could potentially create, I mean, I would be open to an oral amendment that would keep that $1,000 in the program so that you could then give it to someone else. Just a little bit of, I call it a clawback, which I think is a very fair word for it, because, you know, in reality, we are doing we're about rebuilding people's homes. There'll probably be a bill to replace the 2x4s here before long. And, you know, I think in these moments, we need to just step back and say, hey, what would the taxpayers like us to do? And I say just a little bit of money back, and I would ask for a roll call on the A1 amendment.
Representative Hollins, would you like to respond? Well, a roll call being requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Chair Akam, and thank you, Representative Swazinski. I think what your amendment does, I see what you're trying to do. I understand what your goal is, and I think I can appreciate what you're trying to do, and I'm willing to continue having conversations with you about this. I'm going to recommend a no vote on this right now, because our real goal is improving the housing stock for everybody. So whether it's the current owner or it's an improved housing stock for the person who's buying it later. I think that it's important that we upgrade these electrical panels in general for the good of all Minnesotans. Just like a lot of the bills that we're bringing here when we talk about, I don't want to get into weatherization or pre-weatherization, but this is something that will benefit anybody who's going to own this house moving forward. And certainly the people who built the houses 100 years ago were not thinking like, I'm going to put in crummy insulation or, you know, not a very good electrical panel. They're thinking we're doing the best that we can right now for whoever's going to live in it. And all we're doing is trying to upgrade that and make it equitable and accessible to everybody. So for now, I would like to recommend a no vote on the A1 amendment, but I do see what you're trying to get at, and I'm willing to have that conversation with you.
Any further discussion to the amendments? Seeing none, and the roll call, chair votes no.
Representative Kraft?
No.
Representative Sudzinski?
Aye.
Representative Altendorf?
Aye.
Representative Bierman?
Bierman, no.
Representative Carroll?
No, but with the provision that there will be further discussion between the author and
the roll call reflect that.
It shall be reflected.
You don't need to.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes, but no, never mind, just yes.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
No.
Representative Collins?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Igo is gone. Representative Newton?
Hey.
Representative O'Neill?
Aye.
Representative Ream?
No.
Representative Stevenson?
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Any other brief? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Altendorf. Oh, and then Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. I guess I just have, I have a few questions. I know in your original testimony, you had said something about replacing gas stoves. And can you explain to us just a little bit more? Is that something that's coming like as a mandate, or is that something that would just be people wanting to do it on their own? Is that what we're just talking about? I just was wanted to clarify that.
I,
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Altendort. I do not know of any mandate to replace gas stoves.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. I have one more follow-up. So just one thing, when you talked about, this was just very interesting to me because you talked about the electric panel in our homes, that it's not going to support the increased energy usage, you know, as we start to convert the stoves over to electric, you said, or the cars over to electric, you said. So we're you know, at a very, very small in-home level, our electric panels are not going to be able to support the increased electrical use. And I know you said that. And I just think that's a really valid point to make right now, because that's going to be at a much bigger scale as we're pushing more and more of our things, you know, our appliances, our cars, everything onto this electric grid. What you just said is that's going to happen in our home is truly going to explode at a very, very big level. And I don't think we're looking at the unintended consequences that's coming down the road.
And so with that, I'm going to toss it back to Representative Garofalo and then Representative O'Neill, and then we're going to need to take a vote because we do have one more bill and we can't go long tonight. So Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hollins. So electrification, there's times where it's good, there's times where it's bad. I've been an electric vehicle car owner for 9 years. I love my Tesla that my colleague always looks at me when he talks about it. But Representative Hollins, when it comes to the issue you brought up, you brought up a personal example, and I just think it's illustrative. We have a cost-benefit decision-making here at the legislature. And in your situation, if it costs $10,000 to convert from a natural gas furnace to an electric furnace, maybe that's the universe saying that you shouldn't be converting to an electric furnace instead of having other people pay for it. Not you personally, but everybody, right? There's a cost-benefit analysis, and these programs upgrading electric panels, all these things, they're all done for a stated benefit of an environmental benefit. And if we're spending thousands of dollars on infrastructure costs that we have to incentivize to happen, and we're not getting a corresponding environmental benefit, that is failing the cost-benefit analysis. So I didn't mean to personalize it, but you brought up that example, okay, Representative Holland. So I'm just saying, in that situation, like converting from gas furnaces to electric heat, that is a more expensive option. It costs more to heat. That's why we use gas, natural gas and propane in a cold weather state like Minnesota. And the environmental benefits we get out of forcing those conversions are making those conversions, that's why they have to be subsidized, because they don't make sense. So I'm voting no on your bill, but don't let my comments mean anything other than you do make sense. You're just wrong on this bill. Thank you.
Representative Collins, brief comment, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Garofalo. I mean, I also blow a fuse every time we have two laptops running and I turn on a hair dryer. So is that the universe telling me I shouldn't have dry hair? I mean, I live in a 100-year-old house. It just happens, and things have to be upgraded. Thanks.
And we're going to go to last question, Representative O'Neill.
This will be fun. Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Hollins and I had a conversation offline about the smart panel. So we haven't talked at all about smart panel, and I did talk to an electrician this morning who I do talk to every single day. And he had no idea what a smart panel was. So I did my own research, and they do exist, and you actually have a letter in the packet from SPAN, who are the only one I could find in Minnesota that does, or anywhere in the United States that does smart panels. And I looked it up, and a smart panel is $4,350, so $4,350 just for the panel, which I think is like four times as much as a regular panel. I'm trying to remember when I looked at this electrician's invoices, something like that. It's very expensive. But my concern isn't so much the expense. My concern is what it actually does and who has access to it. So, yes, the homeowner will have all this wonderful information from this panel. It'll be telling them, hey, this appliance is using too much electricity, or you're not generating enough from your solar panels or whatever. So it's going to tell you all this stuff. And that's cool. That's nice that the homeowner gets that information. My concern is, what if somebody else has access to that smart device, whether it's intentional or unintentional, that now actually has the ability to start turning your circuits off. So we kind of talked about that offline, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I just want to raise that as a concern, because when we start doing smart technology, this is something that I can literally do from my phone, and I can turn things on and off, and I can get information. So let me just give you a real-world example. So I saw Xcel Energy in here. So I have Xcel Energy, and I've given them permission to turn off my air conditioner when we have peak load. So they have the ability to shut it off. They have a special shut-off, and it's electronic, obviously. So that technology already exists. But this is, like, next level. This is, like, okay, so I get it for the homeowner. That's interesting. But has there been any conversations, Representative Collins, in your conversations with this, since you did add the smart panel language to the delete all, about SPAN and the smart panels and the access, who would have access and what are the potentials and that sort of thing?
And I will just maybe say, since the bill is being laid over, there can continue to be further conversations, and so maybe you can respond to that in any final comments. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. So we had some conversations about the smart panels, and I'm happy to continue those conversations with you and with the experts who are doing this. I think our goal is just to be as efficient as possible with the electrification on the grid. But let's continue the conversations, because your security concerns are real, and I believe, I think we can get to a happy place. That's it.
With that, the bill is laid over and the conversations continue. And with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Kraft and
Google Nest.
Okay, while Chair Akam is moving over there,
Alexa, or like all of it.
I'm going to move that House File 1973 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Folks, we just have attention. Chair Akam, tell us about your bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I'm going to be brief in describing the bill. What it's doing is building on the existing greenhouse gas emissions that we currently have. In 2007 in Minnesota, we passed the Next Generation Energy Act, which set out the greenhouse gas emission reduction goals that were based in the science of that time. And here we are, fast forward to today. We have come quite a long way, and so it's time to update our goals. And so this bill, it updates the goals to be in line with current science as well as in alignment with the Governor Walz's climate framework. And it also looks to make sure that any actions that we're doing at a state level will be mindful of disadvantaged communities whenever possible, and make sure that we're getting regular reporting on the progress that we are making. And with that, there are a few testifiers who are here to present on the bill today.
Great. I have Frank Kolosh, and then next on up is Kate Knuth. I would ask if the next person can come up there, and please 2 minutes max, less if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Frank Kolosh. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I use he, him pronouns. And I appreciate the author's bill and work in climate change and addressing climate action in Minnesota. While this bill isn't part of the governor's proposal, we clearly acknowledge that the bill reflects the emission reduction goals included in Minnesota's climate action framework released in September of 2022. This addresses one pillar of the framework on the emission reductions target, but it also addresses a second pillar on being equitable in climate action in Minnesota. These updated goals represent the most current science in order to minimize the most devastating impacts of climate change. These goals will bring Minnesota in line with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the federal government's nationally determined contributions to address climate change on a global level. The Governor's Advisory Council on Climate Change also emphatically endorsed and identified the importance of including these goals in Minnesota's climate action framework. Before I conclude, I want to note that for the fiscal note, we have had conversations with the author, and we will be amending the fiscal notes to reflect that there is no fiscal impact to the agency based on what we understand now, what the duties caused by the bill for the Pollution Control Agency on an annual basis would be. And with that, we look forward to working with the author as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kolosh. Ms. Knuth, and next is Heidi Root. So, Ms. Knuth, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Dr. Kate Knuth, Managing and Research Director for the 100% Campaign, and I'm here to support House File 1973. The 100% Campaign supports House File 1973 because we're committed to helping Minnesotans build a more equitable, clean energy and climate future. And to do so, we need to reduce emissions rapidly. It's in the global warming of 1.5 degrees, special report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change found people need to reduce emissions 45% by 2030 from a 2010 baseline and net zero by 2050. These are the goals that align with the House File 1973 goals. To put it simply, to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, Minnesota needs to do what House File 1973 sets out as goals for our state. We do know that setting goals alone does not guarantee pollution reductions. The pollution reductions we are seeking will happen, but goals matter. They set the basis for analysis of what Minnesota needs to do and plans to do, and align the work of state agencies, local governments, and private sector partners. Minnesotans deserve to have all of this work striving to do what is actually necessary to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. We support ongoing review of emissions reduction goals, taking into account the science of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We support this, considering this body's work, because the IPCC facilitates a coordinated process bringing together the best climate science and scientists across national governments. There's no better scientific body to look to than them. We're glad to see House File 1973 taking on the challenge of addressing disproportionate impacts of climate change, both in addressing it and from the impacts of climate change itself. This part of the bill will help bring about the more equitable climate future we seek at the 100% campaign. On a personal note, I'm glad to support House File 1973 today. Back in 2007, when Minnesota set its original targets, I was a first-term legislator, and advocating and voting for these goals was a highlight of my legislative service. The goals have made us make real progress on addressing climate change in Minnesota. And here we are 16 years later, and quite a bit has changed. What science shows we need to do to address climate change has changed, mostly because people have not reduced emissions fast enough since 2007. We therefore need to ramp up our efforts even more, and House File 1973 will help us do that. While I'm nervous about climate change impacts ramping up, I've never been more hopeful. I'm hopeful now because I believe in Minnesotans and our ability to do great things together. We are ready to take on climate change, and 1973 will align our state's actions with the scale and pace of what's needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Group, and then on deck is Ellen Anderson. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Root, Chair Akam, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to join you. I'm an assistant professor of climate science and an extension specialist at the University of Minnesota. And I'm here today to specifically address the scientific basis for 1973. The other testifiers have mentioned this. I'm going to sort of lean into where these numbers are derived from. The Paris Climate Agreement committed to the goal of limiting the increase of global temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And to, quote, pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. If current rates of warming continue, global average temperature is likely to reach the 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degree target between 2030 and 2052. That's within the lifetime of most people alive today, and hopefully all of us in this room will be alive to experience a not-so-warm world. But with every amount of additional warming, the costs and challenges of climate impacts increase. A half a degree Celsius warming means billions more exposed to heat waves around the globe, a doubling of losses to U.S. GDP, increased crop losses, worsening water scarcity, and negative effects on human health. Unfortunately, when current global commitments are accounted for, we're on a path to fall well short of these goals. The science clearly outlines that what we choose to do or not over the next 10 to 20 years will determine what the climate future holds for us, all of us in this room. House File 1973 aligns the state's goals with the most recent science produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and importantly addresses the disproportionate impacts and burdens of climate change and climate solutions on different communities and populations. The IPCC outlines and provides many alternative global greenhouse gas emission reductions pathways that get us to these goals. All of these pathways share certain features, including steep near-term emissions and energy demand reductions, net zero by 2050, decarbonization of electricity and other fuels, deep reductions in agricultural emissions, and some form of carbon dioxide removal through carbon storage on land or sequestration in geologic reservoirs. The amended goals in 1973 are supported by the most recent report by the IPCC on mitigation of climate change published in 2022. The report states very clearly, quote, all global modeled pathways that limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and those that limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius involve rapid and deep, and in most cases, immediate greenhouse gas emissions reductions in all sectors. And it's not just robust science that supports these targets. The emission goals, as have already been stated, are aligned with Minnesota's Climate Action Framework, to which over 3,000 Minnesotans contributed. So the state's most recent report on emissions shows we're making progress. We need to do more, and it makes sense to align with the best available science. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Root. Next, Ellen Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Right. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your quick testimony, I hope.
It'll be quick. Thank you so much. I've cut half of it out. I'm Ellen Anderson. I'm a climate program director at Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and we are very proud that we did work with Representative Acomb to create this bill, which we like to call the Next Generation Climate Act, and as Representative Acomb said, that passed in 2007, and at the time we followed the science in 2007, which said that we should reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2050. But now we need a new law because the leading scientists of the world have updated the science and made it clear we face nothing less than a code red for humanity if we don't act. They say we must cut emissions in half in this decade and we must achieve net zero emissions by 2050, and that's exactly what Representative Acomb's bill does. In 2007, we came together to do this, but we do know that we didn't meet those targets. And I would like to say just briefly, what's different? What's different? How do we think that we're going to be able to meet these new targets? So what's really different in 2023 compared to 2007 is that we are all now experiencing the impacts of climate change. Think about winter rain, later summers, extreme droughts, and many more things that we've all seen and experienced. Minnesotans are more concerned about global warming than ever, and they want action taken by their leaders. And what else is different? We now have the technology and we have the expertise to cut carbon while improving our quality of life. And finally, what else is different? I believe this is the year of climate action for Minnesota, which will put us on track to what science tells us, to protect our future of ourselves and our next generations and future generations. And House File 1973 is a giant step towards that future. So thank you, and please vote yes.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to move to member questions and comments, and I've got first Representative Swivinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Akam, can you buy RECs in order to meet this goal?
Chair Akam.
Well, so as a, this is the, that's not, no. The state would be, at least as I understand how the state handles their greenhouse gas inventory at this point, it is not involved buying RECs.
Representative.
So,
Madam Chair, will not going forward. Yeah.
Okay, so Madam Chair, would this bill is as a goal, or will this outlaw coal burning in other states?
Madam Chair.
So this is a goal, just like the Next Generation Energy Act is a goal. It doesn't have penalties, but I'd like that to, I mean, I think we know where we need to go, and this bill just puts into law that that is the direction we need to go.
Madam Chair, if you were able to kind of wave a magic wand, would you like to put penalties in this bill?
Madam Chair.
If I were king, what I want us to do is move toward reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And so I think I have said many times I much prefer carrots than sticks. And so I think that we have opportunities to incentivize the behavior that we want to see.
Okay. Madam Chair, just to finish, you know, you mentioned carrots and sticks. I just want to remind the body here that 3 billion people globally burn feces and sticks to heat and cook their food. So regardless of what we do, when we look at coal, when we look at other means of electrification throughout the world, that 3 billion people burn feces and sticks to cook and heat their homes. So that's right. Cool.
I'm going to move to Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Just real quick, can you please answer Representative Akam? Everyone that testified, are they somehow receiving tax dollars, or they're being supported through the tax dollar program, every one of the testifiers?
Madam Chair.
So I guess I'm not sure I understand your question. Do you mean are they public employees?
Correct. Or they're receiving, like they're a nonprofit and they're receiving taxpayer funding.
I am not sure that I have the financials for those nonprofits. I don't think from MCEA or Dr. Knuth. I think that we have a university professor and a state employee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just let me finish, yep, real quick. So my point is, you know, we continue to pass legislation that's benefiting people. They come in and testify that they need more dollars for the science that they're promoting. And specifically, I just want to comment on the last testifier that she very much said over and over, what's different, what's different? I have that question too, because in the 80s, I was told California was going under. I was told as a child that we were at a destruction if we didn't do something. And now, 40 years later, we're having the same conversation. Thank you.
Okay, final question for Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greatly appreciate it. So my quick question for you, Madam Chair, is will this only be emissions that happen inside the state that are going to be counted?
Madam Chair.
As I understand the emissions inventory taken by the department, yes, it's only within Oh, it looks like maybe he has a clarification if he can run down here really quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kolesh.
Sorry for coming in last year.
No, you're good.
Please state your name real quickly for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Frank Kolesh, Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy with the Pollution Control Agency. To your question, in the most part, it is only in-state emissions. However, the Next Generation Energy Act does require us to calculate emissions for imported electricity, and we have a method to do that, and we do that currently with our greenhouse gas emission inventory.
Okay. So
can I just quick?
If it's 30 seconds, Representative Igo.
Thank you. Was just going to follow up. I think that maybe a way to make this bill better would be to talk about all the things that are coming in for emission-wise, right? Because we were talking about this in House File 7. You know, if we're going to get solar panels and other components from around the world where carbon emissions are high, we should be considering that in our carbon emissions in the state if it's making our state better. Because it's a global environment, it's a global climate, we talk about that a lot. So just a suggestion I have for the bill. Thank you.
Okay, so with that, Representative Makem renews her motion that House File 1973 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is re-referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.